Greetings, podcast listeners. This episode of Venom Exchange Radio is slightly different than our normal MO. Nipper and I had the privilege to be guests on Cold-Blooded Contributions with Ty and Scott Iper. So for this one, we decided to do a little collaboration. We recorded one episode and decided to put it on both network streams. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, I'm Nipper Reed.
And I'm Phil Wolf.
So, settle down, have a nice cup of tea, and enjoy the Venomous Exchange Radio podcast.
Crumpets, Nipper. I want the crumpets.
Well, as you've been such an extraordinarily good boy...
G'day everyone. Welcome to episode number 16 of the Cold-Blooded Contributions podcast. The Cold-Blooded Contributions podcast is proudly sponsored by Midwest Tong. For over 40 years, the Midwest Tongs team has provided the highest quality snake handling tools made in the USA. Made by professionals for professionals. We're your hosts, the Ipers. I'm Ty Iper, and with me is my husband, Scott Iper. This podcast will bring to you people in the hobby who have made an impact on us creatively, be it artistically, with data, or improved husbandry. Today we are stoked to have with us Nipper Reed and Phil Wolf from Venom Exchange Radio. How are you guys?
We're really good. That was so professional. That's way better than we do it.
And Scott.
And that's the first time I've heard you do a whole sentence without swearing. Yeah, that's awesome.
Thank you.
I'm very good, thank you, Ty. I'm just a little bit cold at the moment because over in England it's absolutely freezing.
When you say freezing, Nipper, how freezing is freezing for you?
At the minute it's 6 degrees.
Yeah, that's so pretty damn cold.
Yeah, that's cold. Is that as high as it got to today, 6 degrees?
That's the best today. Overnight it may go down to a negative, but it's cold at the minute.
Yeah, okay. Is that fairly typical for this time of year over there?
Yeah, it is, sadly. It's very miserable. It's drizzle and dark and just not pleasant.
Oh, I thought you were describing your personality then.
Oh, he's off and running.
I did warn you he got up with the shits.
Yeah.
No, I'm awesome.
Say with full confidence, now that I've used my international converter, it is a crisp 21 degrees Celsius where I am.
Lovely. Thank you for being obliging, Phil.
Thank you. And it's ridiculous times that we're doing this as well. All three of us are about as far apart on the globe as possible, with Nipper being in the UK, Phil being in Florida, and us being in Australia. The time for us is 10 to 6 in the morning.
It's disgusting.
Yeah. What time is it over there for you, Nipper?
For me, it is 8 minutes to 8 in the evening.
Right, so a beautiful time.
Oh, you're about to hit your bedtime, aren't you?
I know. You've got 5 minutes and I am going to
bed. Lovely time for Nipper. Phil, what's your time, mate?
I've got 8 minutes to 3 p.m.
Excellent, excellent. And Phil gave everyone a headache at 2:30 this morning, or 2:30 this morning for us, saying that he was changing the times. So thanks, Phil.
Yeah, I dropped the ball royally. The whole thing where you guys are in the future, it just really fucked me up. So. I mean, it's easier for me and Nipper because I just count +5 for him. But you guys, that's literally a whole other day.
The problem is, mate, is that because it's more than 5 fingers for you, you're struggling to count.
Thank God I've got 6.
Don't feel bad, Phil. I fuck up just about every single international one. I have to triple check.
Yeah,
that's right. I fuck them up in Australia. I get the fucking time zones in Australia wrong. So,
anyway. Also, isn't it funky that you guys have certain time zones that don't follow the rhyme? So, isn't it like Victoria's on their own thing, and then Queensland, New South Wales are like an hour apart or something to that extent?
Yeah, so Queensland's different during daylight savings. Queensland's different to everybody else. It was a thing from the farmers saying that they didn't want to change things, so they don't have a daylight savings time, whereas the rest of the country does. So it's just fucking stupid.
Yeah, I don't know why we still do daylight savings. It's atrocious. It takes me a week to recover either way.
I wish we did daylight savings because it does actually make a difference to most people that are working during the day. It gives them that extra hour of light in the afternoon. But anyway, we keep waffling on about stuff. How is Venomous Exchange Radio going this year?
I'd say it's going great. Dipper?
I think it's going great. It's difficult because we have quite niche guests, a lot of those guests are around the globe doing explorey type things, it's quite hard to pin guests down. Oh, it's also quite hard to communicate with guests because sometimes their internet is not as good as other places. But we've been really lucky with some of the guests that we've had on. It's been good this year, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I had the ability of shooting away on a field trip not too long ago and I caught up on your backlog. It was bloody fantastic. I had Phil and yourself, Nipper's dulcet tones, running through the car as I was chasing snakes through Western Queensland and New South Wales.
What could be better?
Finding more snakes.
Finding more snakes, yeah.
ask a silly question, mate. You got to get a silly
answer. Yeah, exactly.
I don't know, being invited on the trip, maybe?
Oh, domestic already. I like it.
Claws out early on.
Wow.
Bam.
Oh, Merry dear. Christmas to us, eh? Hey?
Wow. So how did Venom Exchange Radio come about, guys?
Phil and I talk all the time because he's a lovely man, obviously, and we just felt there wasn't a podcast that lends itself specifically to venomous subjects. There's a lot of reptile podcasts at the minute. In fact, there's hundreds of reptile podcasts at the minute.
Mm.
But a lot of them are quite formulaic in what they do, and a lot of them are quite generalistic in their topics.
Mm.
So we thought it'd be nice just to give the venomous community something specific.
Definitely.
And obviously, as you know, both Phil and I, like yourselves, have a real passion for venomous keeping. So we thought we'd just chat about it and hope somebody wanted to listen.
I think that's the beauty of it in a lot of ways, right, is that your podcast, because it is done by venomous keepers, there's a significant difference in the way the questions are being asked and the way the structure of it, essentially because it's the venomous keepers talking to other venomous keepers.
Yeah.
I find it interesting when I listen to people that predominantly keep non-venomous, whether it be non-venomous snakes or anything else. They might be understanding of venomous husbandry, but they don't understand the nuances of it. And you can see it in the way they ask questions about handling and free handling and all that sort of shit. It's just like, well, hang on, it's not quite as bad as what you think. And then you find yourself having to control some of the things you say because it's not quite the same a non-venomous keeper to a venomous keeper, I suppose.
Yeah, I completely agree. I understand what you're saying, yeah. There's a lot of stuff in social media at the minute which is sensationalising keeping venomous and all the free handling stuff. And there's a massive difference between free handling and tailing something. I'm talking about people that are just trying to get clickbait by doing stuff that is adding risk where there doesn't need to be a risk. So Phil and I are so against that. We just wanted to put out content that was hopefully interesting to people that are into the venomous stuff without any of the theatrics or anything.
I think too, you know, you shouldn't be demonising the fact that you're putting your hands on a venomous snake either.
No.
You can put your hands on a venomous snake in a relatively safe manner, provided that you do it in such a way that you are minimising the chance of a bite, right? That's not saying grabbing a cobra and sticking it around your fucking neck like a nonce, or putting it around and having it nuzzle into your fucking arms and, oh, it's a lovely fucking puppy dog and all the rest of it, and then does it a fucking cheeky little nip onto your fucking arm. You can handle these snakes with your hands along with appropriate tools and still handle them safely, whereas in certain circumstances, using certain tools can actually increase the risk and the danger when you're working with some of those snakes, particularly with really large agile stuff. If you try and use a set of tongs on something and you get those tongs in the wrong place, the action of those tongs is going to cause a significant issue and you're going to have a very unhappy snake that you're trying to work with at the time. And then also to the other side of it, you may actually cause injuries to the snake as well, particularly with more inexperienced keepers where they start to panic and they pull down harder and push down harder, and then you get these other issues as well.
Yeah, one of my favorite things that you've ever said to me, Scott, was a venomous keeper should never use a trap box or a shift box unless they're fully capable of handling the animal without it. And I shared that sentiment. I just didn't know that I shared that sentiment. And it really clicked when you told it to me however many years ago. And you see so many people that get into venomous and they're like, oh, well, I'll just get a shift box. And that way I never have to touch the animal. And it just causes more headaches than not, because the benefits of having the shift box or the trap box, if you want to change the core and not disturb a breeding cycle, or you're trying to rob eggs from the nest or whatever, all these benefits to it, they go right out the window if you don't know how to handle the animal. I think that's some of the stuff that we try to cover in the show, not just showcasing people doing venomous stuff around the world the right way, but seeing that there is right and wrong ways to do it, but who's to say what can't be adapted or altered? And it goes back to you talking about using your hands. We vilify free handlers, but at the same time, we have what we call manual manipulation in the States. And it's like, yeah, you're going to have to get hands-on at some point. You're just not, like you said, swinging a cobra around your head for clickbait.
I think, too, though, the competency, whether it's lack of or having, repercusses on all of us worldwide. Something happens in the States and it then gives our governing bodies a chance to say, well, hang on a minute, this is what's happening over there. Let's look at tightening the laws and whatnot.
Yeah, well, a perfect example is that fucking dropkick at the inland. There's people have been talking about it in Europe. People are talking about it in Australia. People are talking about it in the US. They're talking about it in states other than North Carolina. That's the sort of thing that does actually fucking hurt the hobby. They're literally changing the laws because of a dickhead in North Carolina now. That's the fucking reality. And when they argue that nobody's ever fucking caused issues and change and stuff like that before, well, that's fucking bullshit. There has been issues that have been caused by people handling in a manner that is effectively selfish. Because at the end of the day, they're handling snakes in such a way that if they do have an issue, you're exhausting anti-venom supply, you're exhausting resources for other people. And then there's the arguments that you see about providing anti-venom and all the rest of it. If you're a non-government dispensary or a pharmacy or anything like that, you can't sell fucking drugs. So this bullshit argument to say that, oh, yeah, no, you should be able to provide anti-venom or whatever and they'll get reimbursed. No. They don't need to be reimbursed because they're not allowed to fucking sell it.
But even if they were, why should they have to sell it to someone that has publicly fucking written them off? And then, especially if anti-venom's for pussies.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Hear about places that get vilified because they don't provide anti-venom. Well, fuck me, dude. If it was my anti-venom, I wouldn't be providing it either.
No.
Yeah, I think the bigger issue, that whole scenario, is with the exception of the most recent topic, typically the people that are making, for lack of a better word, making us look bad, if they lost their animals, if their legislation changed, if they were vilified by the community and they don't have animals anymore, they don't care. They've already made their hundreds of thousands of dollars on YouTube. They've made their millions on YouTube. They're going to move on to the next thing. They're going to have a business that is their actual livelihood. They don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, every single person that I know that has these animals, as much as they do love them, if they were taken away tomorrow because of the horrible things that they're portraying on the internet, they don't care. They have other businesses. They have other livelihoods. It makes no difference to them. Mm-hmm. Well, as us, it's what we do. It's our lives. So it plays a huge factor.
Even if it isn't your livelihood, why should you be robbed of something that you love, that you are doing all the correct things with because of someone else?
Yeah, agreed.
The thing is, I've said it before, I don't see those people as part of the venomous community. You don't see the carnival shooting gallery people as part of the gun community or something like that, right? Okay, so yeah. If you've got people that are acting literally as a fucking sideshow, saying, look at me, I can do this, that doesn't make them part of that actual community. They just happen to be using something that is part of a community and using that as a way of demonstrating themselves. And, you know, I'm a dancing fucking monkey, give me money. That's all they are. What do you guys keep? What's new for you this year?
For me, what's new this year? What have I got? Boyga Flavesons.
Lovely.
Because we can't get the Australian ones, I'll have to put up with Boyga Flavesons. They're very nice looking snakes, but they are nowhere near as nice as your night tiger. It really is a poor man's night tiger, but it is the closest we can get.
I've seen irregular turning up now at Egypt.
There is. Yeah. And how did they get there?
Probably through the same portal that everything else fucking turns up.
Exactly.
The Czech Republic,
Everything's Czech Republic. Yeah, this year there has been a handful of irregularis for literally sell your kidney prices. But no, the Flavesons are beautiful. I really, really like them. Great looking.
As long as you're selling someone else's kidney, right?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. What else have I got? I've got a lot of non-venomous stuff this year. I've got file snakes, which are really interesting. Nice. So I've got a nice big tray of dirt. and I never see the snakes, but I know they're in there somewhere.
So I was thinking you were talking about Acrocortis then, as opposed to...
No, I'm talking about cross-eye, the Cape file snakes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Do they fluoresce under UVA?
I don't know. I've not tried it, but as soon as this is finished, I'm going to, now you've said that.
Do yourself a favour and have a look.
I'll do it. Yeah, that'd be wicked.
Well, I think the interstitial skin between the, obviously the skin between the scales, I believe it may fluoresce a little bit.
Really? Mm. I'm so going to try that. That's awesome. Mm. And I have bought a ton of milk snakes and king snakes, lots of Arizona mountain kings and that sort of thing. I managed to track down, not your cup of tea at all, but I got a trio of Stuart's milk snakes.
Give them back to Stuart.
Hey! Wow. I doubt there's many in the UK of those. They're really hard to get. And I've been spending an awful lot of money on geckos. Oh.
Are you starting to get into Australian carpodactylus or something?
I've got quite a few Australian geckos. I love an Australian gecko. You are very spoilt with what you have. I've got Oegira monolis, Oegira castlenaui, Strophurus ciliaris, Strophurus genicorda. Yeah, so I love an Australian gecko.
Can I ask a rude question?
Yeah.
What do they go for over there? What's the average price? Any one of them? Well, like, what's minimum and max?
Castlenaui for a juvenile. They've come right down in price now. They used to be extortionate, but now you'll probably pick up a juvenile for £200, £250. Mm-hmm. The ciliaris, there's quite a lot of people breeding ciliaris now, so they probably, for a hatchling, £150, £200.
Okay.
Chenacorda, slightly more than that. Some of them, though.
I was just at the Daytona Reptile Expo this past August, and there was a ton of people with ciliaris, and anything under a year old was the only thing for sale, and they were all about $450. So,
yeah.
Okay,
So just to throw it out there, ciliaris is a species complex of at least 7 species.
Is it what, sorry?
Ciliaris is 7 species. There's 7 species sitting within ciliaris.
Oh, okay.
So what I've seen from the animals that are overseas, for the most part, they are ciliaris from Top End, which are the largest version of them.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they are a fairly distinct group, I suppose, within it. But the paper that describes Strophurus chrysalis shows the genetic variation within the others there. And the problem was is there was a lot of work that needed to be done outside of Queensland to determine species delimitation within those things. So that wasn't done in that paper, and it's never been done since. So at some point in time, someone may come along and split them all up. Where possible, if you can keep your ciliaris localities clean, then when they come to actually splitting them up, you might be in a better position.
No, that's cool. Yeah. Super popular. Australian geckos have really taken off in the UK at the minute. They're really popular. And, some of them are extremely expensive. I've also been buying a lot of Lycianus, which are expensive. But I'm kind of obsessed with the locality, the fact that they're on such tiny little islands. it does something to me. And when you've got an island that's less than a kilometre long and less than half a kilometre wide, and you've got a variant on something that small, I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, definitely.
It's pretty incredible the size of those geckos too. I mean, they're probably the largest predator on that island.
Yeah, they're definitely apex predators, certainly on some of the islands. I won't bore the arse off everybody, but New Caledonia, I would love to herp there. It's just such a unique little biosphere.
Fly to Australia, mate, and then we'll go to New Caledonia.
Yeah, I know.
Wow, another trip I'm not going on.
No, you're definitely going on that one. Definitely going on that one. I just want to go chase a lot of cork.
Yeah, honestly, that's just the Bavayas and all the different gecko species out there are so unique to that little island chains. It's brilliant. Love to go there.
There's a great book on the herpetofauna of New Caledonia by Aaron Bauer and Ross Sadler.
Yeah, I've got that. It's well thumbed in my collection.
Yeah. And they've got an incredible sea snake collection over there as well. There's a heap of sea snakes over that are very interesting. And there's a really good book on the sea snakes of New Caledonia as well. It's bilingual, which is pretty cool. It's done in English and French on the same page. You often see some of the Mexican titles have got half English, half Spanish. Well, it's nice to see a half English, half French version of the same thing.
Yeah, 100%. So that's it. That's what I've been spending my pennies on this year.
What about you, Phil?
Well, I've had a relatively light year for acquisitions. Venomous-wise, I got a pair of, they were neonates at the time. Now they're about a year old. Namibian puff adders. that are from a particular locality that eludes me as we speak, of a European line, I think German. They're beefing up beautifully. They're so colorful. And I've never had Namibian locality puffs before. I've always had some of the West African stuff and Tanzanian, some South African stuff. I've got capes as well. And the Namibian, man, they're just screamers. And then I wound up picking up over the summer some more Sabacularis, Spacos rat snakes. Got another locality pair. And that's about it for acquisitions this year. It's been a very light year. I've been trying to focus on getting the room well-rounded in terms of temps and humidity and upgrading vivariums, going from tubs to vivariums and sorts. So that's where the main focus has been. I wish I had more new stuff as well.
Didn't you finally get yourself a ring as well for Anna Marie this year?
Well, technically, it was last year. It was our one-year engagement anniversary in November. So.
Oh, okay.
I would have said that was a surprise. I haven't said pretty anything close yet and made him feel really bad.
Yeah, she doesn't know yet.
Yeah. I wouldn't have felt bad. I would have been like, oh, that's a bit awkward, but I wouldn't have felt bad.
I was going to say, she's going to listen to this and say, oh, so I'm a new acquisition, am I?
It's very early in the morning for us. I apologize.
The most important acquisition, Bill. That's how you phrase it.
Yes. Well said, sir. Well said. A veteran.
Definitely the most expensive, I'll tell you that.
1,000%.
How did you guys actually meet?
Believe it or not, we met on a dating app. I like to tell people some crazy story of heroism and a white horse, but no, we met a few years back on the dating app, and both of us were kind of just striking out left and right, and it was one of those dating apps where you actually have to pay for it. We're like, all right, we'll pay for a month and figure the people that are also paying for it, they're serious. And we met each other on like day three of the app, and that was it. So our theory worked.
There you go.
I thought you were talking about how Nipper and Phil met.
I did. I was going to say. No, me and Phil met on a dating app. It was a really weird dating app.
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
It was very niche. Very niche.
Asking about Nipper and me? I'm sorry. I thought we were just talking
because I was trying to figure out. Yeah, like I was like, sure Nipper had been with Alison longer than that.
I was sitting there thinking to myself, Justin Smith, now I got a fucking dating app thing going on.
Yeah.
Right. Well, now you got to keep all that crap in the show.
Oh, 100%, mate. That's staying in there. It's not coming out.
I like the look on Nipper's face. Nipper's sitting there nodding, going,
I definitely knew what you were talking about, Ty, and I just, I ran with it. We met because Phil kept sending me nudes onto my Instagram account.
I mean, that is true.
Is that why you had issues on your dating apps, Phil? Because you were just sending out fucking photos the whole time.
It is.
Phil and I, we moved into the similar circles for a long time. We've known quite a lot of the same people. It was inevitable, I think, we'd start talking to each other at some point, I think.
Sorry, I can't get past the dating app.
Basically the same thing. I'm pretty sure, I don't know if Nipper was on NPR, Morelia Python Radio, and I remember saying to myself, I know that guy. I think we've talked before. And then I pinged him online for something, and we chatted back and forth, and then we were doing the Herpetoculture magazine, and I'm pretty sure Nipper was contributing to that and talking to Justin Smith about that, and we just kind of clicked. And man, I talked to him more than most of my friends that live down the street. Am I wrong in saying that, Nipper?
No, I completely agree. I think this is one of the beautiful things, and I know I'm ancient and you're all quite young, but this is one of the real benefits of the internet as we are now. Yeah. For people in any particular hobby, but our hobby, which is quite niche, for want of a better word, you can talk to like-minded people. It doesn't matter where they are in the world. And I would say most of the people that I talk with on a regular basis aren't in the UK, because we're spread around the globe, but we all share the same interests.
I thought you were going to say, you miserable cunt.
You are, to be fair, but you're my miserable cunt.
Wow. The best compliment I've had today.
Yeah.
I might just add this in, because any of the people from the UK have probably just fallen off their chair.
Exactly.
Because that word in Australia is used as a term of endearment for the most part.
You substitute it for mate.
So as opposed to in other places around the world, that's a way of getting into a knuckle up pretty quickly.
Yeah. It does make me laugh how common it is in an Australian conversation, and that in the UK it would just be people passing out or punching you. It's completely unacceptable in the UK.
There yeah, as long as you got that Australian twang of an accent, I think people would
sit down get away with it.
Oh yeah, he's just a bloody Australian. Okay.
He's just Australian. Yeah. He's got flip flops on. Yeah. You'd be fine,
thongs, mate. Thongs.
Thongs. We are so lucky how we are at the moment. When I first started herping, you think no one else is doing this. I'm just some, you know,
weirdo just
crawling around. Yeah, just some weirdo crawling around in the mud looking at stuff. And then the internet comes along, because I forget I'm old enough to remember pre-internet.
So are we.
Yeah, well, you don't look it, darling, but I do.
I love you.
And all of a sudden, you can then speak to somebody else who's doing it in real time. I literally sent videos, probably to Phil, of me being next to a pond in Milos with vipers and going, look, this is here now.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It's one of the few benefits of the internet. Unfortunately, we have to put up with all the other rubbish that comes with it.
I'll make sure I send you some videos of some of the other things that I'm encountering at the time.
Oh, mate, I love
just,
it.
I'll call you live and... That way then you can...
We'll do it in the middle of the day when the sun's out and it's nice and warm. And...
Yeah. Honestly, there's nothing better than when I'm having a really shitty day at work and Scott phones me and goes, I've just found this. Thanks, mate. Thanks, mate.
That's all right. It's good fun. You sit there and you're living vicariously through other people.
Mate, I love it. I absolutely love it. It is a blessing. I'm really fortunate that I am friends with people that have such interesting and different lifestyles. I really am blessed that I can talk to you two and you're out in Australia herping. Or I can talk to Phil and he's wading up to his waist in Florida catching amphumas or something. It's brilliant. I'm really, really lucky.
Or getting shot at.
As I say, and I've said it before, I've been fortunate enough to travel around the world a lot and I've been to some very, very sketchy places. Florida is the sketchiest place I've ever been. Hands down, I've herped Israel more than once, and Florida still is the worst.
We are totally going to Florida.
We're not going to nightclubs. We're not going to restaurants. We're in the middle of the swamp, and the only other people there are herpers, fishermen, or people doing bad shit.
Yeah. Honestly, if I had a little spotter book of meth labs, it would be full now, because... Just driving around, you hear all the rumours, oh yeah, Florida's got meth labs and weird people with no teeth and face tattoos and all that sort of stuff. And it really is like that. It's honestly an edgy as fuck place.
Thought it was full of old people.
No, Florida's like fucking Walmart without fucking walls.
Yeah, it is.
We're totally going to Florida.
And I've herped Israel, I've herped Albania and Romania, some sketchy places. I would not recommend, Phil might disagree with me, but I would not recommend herping Florida without a local person as a guide.
Wow.
Unless you're going to stay to the national parks and that sort of thing. But if you are going to go into the, it's not outback, what do you call it, Phil?
Yeah, we call it the country, or we always call it the Everglades, even though 90% of the time you're not in the actual Everglades. We still call it the Everglades. So.
But if you're going off on your own to herp in the Everglades, I would definitely not want to do it without a local.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a famous story, real quick, there's a famous story of a guy who was, I guess, I don't know if he was birding or maybe he was a frog guy, but he was out herping in one of our state parks. And the state park, I think it's 163,000 acres. And the Florida Turnpike, which is one of our largest highway systems, actually cuts the park in half, directly in half. And there's tunnels underneath for animals and vehicles to drive through if you're off-road or what have you. Well, this guy was out there taking pictures, and a storm came in. And in theory, he could have just walked due west and hit the turnpike and been fine. He would have had shelter underneath the turnpike, underneath the highway, but he didn't. He got turned around. He was lost for 3 days in this one area that is, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just swamp. So it gets very congested in the urban areas, very congested in the boonies, in the bush, in the glades, whatever you want to call it. you really should have someone local to point you in the right direction.
So 3 days, he walked for 3 days and he wasn't found, or he was?
Yeah, no, he went up finding the highway, and he climbed up on top of the overpass that goes over the swamp and flagged somebody down to find it. But he was just wandering through the woods for 3 days.
Fair enough. We have people wander through the bush here for 3 months and then they just fucking die.
Yeah.
Remoteness, for me, I suppose, is a little bit different from us to you guys, I suppose.
It's not that, for me, it's not the remoteness, because anyone can follow a GPS. It's the people that are out there.
Yeah.
It was definitely, definitely edgy.
Wow.
Yeah. Cool. There you go.
And I would not want to be driving around out there without a firearm,
100%. Yeah. Yeah.
Fucking blows my mind, eh? People talking about going herping in the US and they're all carrying guns.
I was the same. I come from the UK where it's difficult to own a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got in the car. Phil is so American, it's painful. If he goes to the shops, he's armed to the teeth. He's got a gun on his hip. He had a gun in the glove box and he had a rifle in the boot of the car. And he said, oh, they're there, blah, 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 blah. And Phil knows that I am confident with firearms, mm-hmm, because of work and stuff. So he just said, they're there. And I'm thinking, why the fuck is he telling me about firearms in the car? 2 days in, I'm like, right, I'm really glad there's a firearm there. I'm glad we got that in the boot. And it's just, it's a dodgy place to herp.
Wow. Phil, we're coming over.
Whenever you guys are ready.
Adamantius, mate. Adamantius. So.
Speaking of herping, where have you guys been this year?
If we're taking away way more places than I have this year.
Oh, God, I'm trying to think back where I've been this year. The year's nearly over.
You knocked your snake off, didn't you?
I did. So I'm trying to think where I went before that. I went to, I think, Canary Islands first. I love the Canary Islands because the Canary Islands is a small island chain. It's actually owned by Spain, but it's off of Africa. So it doesn't count as Europe, although it feels quite European, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And the thing I like about the Canary Islands is each island has endemic herps, but there's only a few of them. So most islands only have 3 different herps on them.
Okay.
So they tend to have an endemic skink, an endemic gecko, an endemic lacerted style lizard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite nice. So I can go with Alison. It's really hot and sunny. She can do sunbathing, and it's not that difficult to find the species on that island. And then you go to the next island, which you can almost see from the island that you're on, and then there's another different 3 to look for. So it's quite easy herping.
Yeah.
For the most part, there is some incredibly rare stuff that's harder to find, but by and large, it's quite easy. So I love the Canary Islands. I'm about halfway through the Canary Islands list. I did an early trip to Bulgaria on the Black Sea coast, so ex-Soviet Union, now part of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for the Nemesis, my last snake in Europe, which I've been trying for so long to find. It's really hard, which is the blotch snake. And that is one of the biggest snakes in Europe. Can get to about 2 meters. Really quite heavily scaled. And it's like a specialist of marshland. Its sort of habitat is brackish water from the sea into fresh water, and it kind of feeds seasonally on wading birds.
Okay.
So is it like a mega-sized Nerodia?
Yeah, very similar. If you imagine someone gave Nerodia a load of steroids, what? That's kind of the body shape, and but it's just bigger.
So are they keels as well?
Yeah, the very keeled scales. And I've been trying for maybe 10 years to find one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a common snake. It's one of those annoying snakes, and you probably have the same sort of thing in Australia, where herpers can never find them.
But birders
find them all the time.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of that is because the best habitat for them is the Black Sea coast of Bulgaria, and the main areas for it is also the main areas for bird watching, because you get all the migrating eagles and vultures and wading birds from the Soviet Union come across there. So it's really switched on for birding out there. And you'll get so many shots of this snake from a bird hide. It's so annoying. And that if you go out herping for it, you can't find it.
Yep.
So I had a trip out there. We found lots of other great stuff. Loads of Amadites vipers, which is an iconic, very popular in the hobby viper. We saw some nice examples of those. We found lots of Natrix. We found lots of the newly described green lizard and all that sort of thing. So it was a nice trip.
Yep.
But I'm sure you kind of feel it as well. If you've gone for a specific target, it can be quite stressful.
Yeah, trying to find it. And then if you don't, you sort of feel really let down with the whole holiday. Yeah,
exactly that. And it's not cheap to get out there.
No.
It's one of the more expensive things. So I flew out there with some friends. We did Bulgaria really, really well. And then my friend had to fly home because he couldn't get that much time off. So me and my other friend, Trev, that I do most of my herping with, mm-hmm. we thought, right, we're going to drive from Bulgaria into Greece. We thought cleverly we'd take a shortcut, and rather than go the long way round all of Bulgaria and then into Greece, we'll cut across Turkey, which was a mistake. Turkey is on a sort of war footing at the moment. They do not like foreign people, and we had a real mare getting into Turkey. We were held for hours at the border checkpoint. I mean, my camera kit's not super expensive. It's about $5,000's worth. But Trev's camera kit's about $20,000's worth of camera kit. And they are, like, pulling our bags Ooh. Out and chucking them on the floor and just being absolute knobs. We had to pay a certain amount of money to continue.
Are you afraid of Florida?
Yeah, well, yeah. It's, at least these people had teeth and... minor tattooing, not face tattoos.
I don't know, man. I think I'd be a little bit more keen with some toothless backwoods hillbillies in Florida than the Turkish military.
So, we had a rough time getting across. So we drove across Turkey for a bit, and then we drove out the other side into Greece. And then, obviously, the Greeks thought we were coming from Turkey, and we were Turkish, so we got turned out by the Greeks, and it was all a bit of a...
clusterfuck.
A bit of a mission, a bit of a clusterfuck.
Turkey is part of Asia, or is that part of Europe?
So Turkey is a real anomaly because some of Turkey is in Europe and some of Turkey is in Asia, but none of it counts for a European species list, be it birds or animals.
Okay.
So geographically, the tip of Turkey is in Europe, but the bulk of Turkey is Asian, so it counts as Asia, but it touches part of Europe.
Yeah,
that makes sense. So we went into Greece that time of year. We was in that part. It's called the Evros Delta, and it's a massive marshland area for hundreds of miles. Absolutely stunning. And we got there, and it was the best time of year to go because all the flowers were in bloom, which meant all the butterflies were out and all the dragonflies were out. And I was just like a miserable fuck because I hadn't found the snake. Trev hadn't seen the Ottoman viper, which is Europe's biggest venomous snake. And not annoyingly, I mean, it's great for Trev, but I found one in about 20 minutes. there you go. You've got your tick. But it's a cracking snake. I've seen them before, but it's a beautiful looking viper. So we saw that. We saw another species that Trev hadn't seen, which is a really, really pretty little lacerted lizard, snake-eyed lacerted. So we got all our targets there. So that was a good trip. We was with another chum of mine who actually lives in Bulgaria, but met us out in Greece. And he stayed out, and then Trev and I flew home. And then I went back out the following week to hurt with him, and he had one that he found. He went, look at this. And to see it was incredible. Just the relief was, because it's one of these things. I was so close to finishing the European list, but it could have gone on for another 20 years because this snake is so rare and hard to find. So to see one, all the weight went off my shoulders. So that was good. So I had two trips to Bulgaria. I then, when did I go? I went out to America again, and Rob Stone organised the best. Literally, you couldn't wish for a better rattlesnake trip.
Better talk about that trip, because I did not come on that trip, and I'm going to probably regret it forever. But go on, sorry.
Honestly, you couldn't have a better trip. So we went out to try it because we've done a Utah trip before. So I flew out to Vegas and then met everybody and we drove into Utah. The trip before, we kind of had to hedge our bets weather-wise. So some of the rattlesnakes come out early in the year, some come out later. You can't really do a trip where you're going to tick everything because unless you're going to be out there for about a month.
Yep.
And we didn't have that much time, obviously. So we did the cooler ones in the first trip and we did the ones that come out later in the year on this trip. But for me, who's really into rattlesnakes, these were all really, really iconic species. So it's like Crotalus concolor, Crotalus abyssus. Help me out, Phil. I can't think what else we saw.
Lutosus.
Lutosus, yeah. Which I'd seen before, but it's just great to see. Lutosus is such a pretty snake, but the different colour forms are ridiculous.
Yeah.
You go from the ones that look like lichen that really match the rocks in that area, and then you get into the red desert bits, and they're white with big black bands and spots look like a completely different snake. So that was nice to see again. Cookies and cream, absolutely, yeah. But the one I really, really wanted to see, I mean, we saw the Hopi rattlesnake on a Hopi Indian reserve, which was phenomenal. As I say, the midget faded, something I'd wanted to see for 20 years, is, you know, to see a midget faded in the flesh was really good, and we found three of those. But I really wanted to see the Grand Canyon rattlesnake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but isn't Abyssus the same thing as Atrocodartis? It's just a bullshit thing these days?
Potentially. I mean, they're all potentially bullshit.
They're both
bullshit.
Valid. You shut your mouth, sir.
Yeah.
You tell him, Phil.
Pop me a Philip.
And so Rob had this brilliant idea of, let's climb to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, look for rattlesnakes, and then climb out of the Grand Canyon in the same day, which was good. Now, the temperatures, probably not by your standards, but for me as an Englishman, temperatures were insane. So we didn't start descending the Grand Canyon until about 7 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still about 80 at 7 o'clock at night. It was hot out there.
What was the relative humidity?
It was high, but I'd say, I guesstimate about 70 or 80. It was...
Yeah, it's fucking warm.
Unpleasant.
Like, you'd know about
that. Yeah, it was harsh. So I was really pleased because we found, or Justin found, a king snake early on down our descent. Mm-hmm. And it was a subspecies that I hadn't seen before, so that was really good. I'm not going to lie, it was a hard descent, and if you don't like heights, it's not the place to be.
Why did you descend at that time?
Yeah, 7 o'clock at night. A, you want to be at the bottom of the Grand Canyon when the rattlesnakes are coming out, obviously, because they're nocturnal. But in the daytime, doing physical exertion... Yeah, in like 110 degrees would just be rubbish.
So how far down is it? How many k's?
It's 5 miles down, not in a straight line because you zigzag all the way down. So the actual path is 5 miles down.
How long did it take roughly?
To get to the bottom, bear in mind we're stopping quite a lot to take photographs of snakes, and we wasn't rushing to get to the bottom. So I think it took to memory around 5 hours or something, 4 hours, something to get to the bottom.
Yep.
And some of the paths are airy. Some of the switchbacks, you're talking the paths, if you've got a rucksack on, you've got your back against the wall and you're stepping along the wall to get past obstacles and stuff like that. So if you're not good with heights, it's not a great place to be. Some of the places were gripping, put it like that.
Yeah.
And there's also some places where there's waterfalls running down the rocks, and the scenery is beautiful. Birds, fantastic. Anyway, so you get to the bottom and I was just thinking, fuck, we've got to climb out of this. And I really wanted to be out. Go on, Phil, sorry.
I wasn't there on the strip, but where they were, from the rim to the very bottom of this canyon where they were, is just under a mile of depth.
Okay.
It's deep, yeah. So I thought, we're going to leave with enough time to get up to the top before the sun got up too high. And I thought, oh, so that's probably going to give us 2 hours of searching or something like that. And then Dustin found a rattlesnake and a cracking adult specimen. He found one in about half an hour. So we had about 45 minutes to an hour of photo time, and then we set back up. Going up is a lot harder than coming down.
I bet.
And also, when you've been up all night as well, it's not great to then have to climb out 5 miles and get back to the car. And by that time, it was fucking freezing. But we did it. Just an incredible experience.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no sleep for over 24 hours, but totally worth it.
Yeah.
Absolutely totally
worth it. You don't remember the pain of the walk. You don't 100%. Remember the fucking tiredness, how tired you are. You don't remember the dehydration for the most part, and the headaches and all the rest of the shit, and the aches and the pains.
Yeah.
You remember getting those photos. You remember
100%.
How elated you felt when you put your eyes on that snake at the time.
Honestly, yeah. I just find it really weird. Somebody that lives in the UK that's been reading about Abyssus for 20-odd years to actually see one.
Yeah.
Incredible. And then we finished the trip off in good style because we went to Nevada, which is also very hot, and we got, trying to think which way around was it. Was it Mitchell-I, Phil, or Stevens-I? I think it was Mitchell-I, wasn't it?
It's Mitchell-I, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we got a beautiful specimen, and if for anyone that's interested, have a look on my Instagram because there's a really nice shot of that, like blue-cheeked, just a real big specimen of Michelinite. It's really good. Honestly, if I'd have seen one of the species on that trip, it would have been worth it.
Yep.
But to see all of those on one trip, plus lots of other herps as well, we saw some incredible lizards, like particularly the collared lizards in their breeding colours. Yeah, just a mind-blowing trip. Fantastic.
You mentioned your Instagram, mate. Have you got your 1,000 followers yet?
No. Come on, people. Sort your shit out. I need...
God, I love you.
I think I need about... I can't remember. I think I need about 150 more to get over 1,000. Come on.
All right.
Make an old happy. So, come back from America, and then as far as European species go, I've only got two lizards, or I had two lizards left to see, and that was the end of every European herp species. So I went with Ali to an island called Zamos, which, going back to our earlier conversation, is a little bit weird. So Zamos is a Greek island, but it's only 1 kilometre off the coast of Turkey. So technically, heptafauna-wise and flora-wise, it's Asian, but it's a European island. Makes not a little sense. And there's a little rock lizard there, which is really, really hard to find. The densities are so low. And even though...
So how many did Ali find?
I don't want to talk about it. I want to talk about it. So I'll tell you the story. So we had 5 sites that friends had given me. My friends are good herpers, and they'd spent all day at these sites, and they'd seen maybe 1 or 2. The densities are really low. So we tried 3 of the sites all day, and these are hard sites. These are like mountain ravines with narrow streams running down. That's their sort of habitat type. And no joy. Temperatures were right, habitat was bang on, couldn't find any. So we went the next day to a site, and we got there just as the sun was coming up, and it got to lunchtime, and we'd been crawling all over rocks, and we was really fed up. And then I said, I'm just going to climb up this next waterfall and see if there's anything. And I saw one, and I called Ali, and she came running over, and I said, I need to go back to the car because I need a long lens, because we're not going to get close to these. They're quite high up on the rocks. And I said, all right, just sit there and watch where this lizard is basking, and I'm going to go back to the car. So about 20 minutes later, I get back to her, and she's gone, there's one there, there's one there, there's one there. And she'd found 4 in the time. So that was good. And the thing is, while I was looking for my long lens, she'd taken a picture of one on her phone. So, but I was really stoked to see that. So I shall finish the year with only one European herp to see, which I'm going to go for early next year. And that's the newly described green lizard on Naxos.
I wonder how many are on the way as well. How many things are about to be found?
To be fair, that after I've seen the lizard on Naxos, I'm going to go straight to Portugal because they've just split the marbled newt.
Yeah.
It looks exactly the same, but apparently it's different. So I'm going to do that as an insurance tick. It's not on the list yet, but it will be at some
point. How many of the subspecies are you missing there for Europe?
It depends what we're talking about. I've seen most of the snake subspecies. I haven't seen, venomous-wise, I haven't seen Vipera amidites Gregor Warneri. That's in Austria. I haven't seen that. I need Viper aspis hugii on Sicily. I haven't seen that particular one. As far as the grass snakes go, there's about, I think, 29 subspecies. So I've seen some of them, but they all look pretty much the same.
Sounds just like locality. That could be a little side quest for you, mate.
Oh, yeah, don't get me wrong. There's a load of salamanders that I just want to see locality variants of and things like that. Lizard-wise, if you're talking about like our common wall lizard, I think there's 40-odd, 50-odd subspecies. It's looks the same. It's just in a different sort of area.
Yeah.
And our European pond turtle, I think, has got 30 subspecies or something like that. I'm not over-bothered. If I'm in an area and they're there, I'll go and take pictures of them. But unless it's venomous, I would like to do all the venomous subspecies. So I've seen most of them.
Yeah.
I must admit, we did the linguistics on the Chimera book for salamanders and newts, volume 4. And after seeing how threatened a lot of them are, they sort of got moved up my list quite rapidly.
Wait, which book was that?
It was the Threatened Species of Salamanders and Newts, Volume 4 of the German Herpetological Society's document. So it's a group of scientific papers by different authors, obviously talking about threatened newts and salamanders and how you can effectively maintain them successfully in captivity.
And how low the numbers are when they're out searching for them.
Okay.
They publish it in English. And so because it's predominantly written by Germans and then translated, we do a translation validation, I suppose, and fix up any errors. Yeah. And then at the same time as well, we're sort of looking at it from a peer review point of view as well.
What did they say was the most endangered? I'm guessing Europroxus monseni, something like that?
Yeah, I think it was something along those lines.
Yeah.
I can't.
I was very, very pleased to see that because I think with habitat destruction and temperature rises, I can't see that being around. The numbers are so low now.
Climate change is a pretty unrelenting beast. We're going to start to see quite a few localised extinctions and full extinctions due to climate change, unfortunately.
Climate change in humans, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you, Phil? You had a good trip this year.
Yeah, nowhere near as extensive as your gauntlet of expedition, but I did some bopping around locally and saw a few things. And my one trip that I did this year was to West Texas with our fearless leader, Robert Stone. The trip was actually kind of interesting because we were supposed to go out there with four or five guys, and things got turned around, and two of our friends from Arizona that were driving from Arizona to West Texas, they got the dates wrong because instead of following the...
Did you give them the time?
Instead of following the instructions on Facebook Messenger, they were going off of a handwritten cocktail napkin from 6 months prior, and they left for the trip a week early. So
better than light.
None of the... Yeah, right. So it was actually really interesting. So the two of them ended up finding completely different species than Rob and I found. But it was actually really fun to just have like a duet in West Texas. I thought it was a very cool experience. Saw some species that we'd seen before, but the main mission was for us to find a model rock rattlesnake, Crotalus leptis leptis. And we looked real hard and we finally found one. And it's a funny story. We have these things called cuts on the highway. And for those listening who are unfamiliar, basically when the highway, or the motorway, whatever you call it, when they're paving these roads, instead of driving around a rock mound or around a mesa or a hill or even a mountain, they'll just dynamite the fence and go straight through the middle.
That doesn't sound like the Americans just plowing through something. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like us at all. So what you have now is these beautiful rock escarpments, just a straight sheer wall cliff. Sometimes it's 6 feet tall, sometimes it's 200 feet tall. It just depends on how big the foothill or the rock that you're traversing, they bulldoze through. So what we do is you pull up to one of these rock walls, you park your car, you get out and you just walk along the side of the road looking for stuff. And it is extremely daunting. We're talking hours and hours and hours in the car, as well as hours and hours on foot, just staring at rocks. But everything lives on these rock walls. They love it. The temperature variation, the microclimates. So here we are looking for this rattlesnake that looks like rocks, looking at rocks. And finally, I said to Rob, I said, hey, man, didn't someone say that they found him on top of the cliff? And I know Rob's going to kill me when he listens to this. He's screaming at the radio. I can hear him now. I don't remember who the person was, but yes, that was the case. So what happens is you're doing this at 2, 3 in the morning, and these giant road train-sized semi-trucks are just barreling down. So you can see them, you can hear them for miles away because there's no sound out there. Nothing's going. And, you know, you hear the truck, and you hug against the wall and hope that it doesn't waffle you. Well, this truck is coming, and I say to Rob, hey, why don't we check the top? And Rob starts walking up the hill, up the side where, like, the cliff starts, and the truck passenger is coming, and I hear him say something along the lines of, son of a bitch, or oh, my God, or something like that. And then he immediately responds with, I'm okay, stay where you are. So it's like, all right, clearly he's not hurt. I should hug the wall so I don't get run over by this giant shipping truck. The truck passes. I walk over, and he's standing right in front of one of the most beautiful model rock rattlesnakes you've ever seen.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, that was a very fun trip to just have duet. You know, we usually go on these trips with four or five guys, and the camaraderie is always amazing, but it is more personal to have it with just one other person. It's also a little more carefree because we kind of just do whatever we want, whenever we want. Oh, we don't feel like going there. And nobody else is going to stop us or complain about it. Let's just change it up.
Yeah.
So we got to see that. And we wound up finding out that where we were is arguably the rarest locality of that snake. So our first model rock rattlesnake in the wild was the hardest one to find. And we met up with some other herpers that are locals to the area. They live there. And we showed the pictures like, man, that thing is beautiful. It took me 12 years to find one that looked close to that. It's like, wow, we got super lucky. At the same time, we were so close to El Paso, Texas, that our good friend Kyle Vargas, also known as the Glob King, he has an incredible collection. So we reached out to him and got to spend time with his collection and see some of those amazing rattlesnakes. Didn't even know it's this stuff from Mexico and Southwest United States and South America. Just absolutely incredible. And then he was kind enough to take us into the Franklin Mountains to try and find the Franklin Mountain locality Glob Rye, which is probably my, I'll show the comment, that locality of Glob Rye is my favorite one. Just stark contrast, black with gray with black bands, very clean, very crisp, and it's just amazing landscape. Just traversing the side of these mountains with these rock slides and finding rattlesnakes. So I didn't have as many adventures as Nip Nip, but my 1 week in West Texas, you know.
I'm so jealous of you two. I want to know, what's the worst injury you guys have had on a herp trip?
I've had loads.
I'll
go first.
Messed myself up a lot. I had malaria in Borneo. I was given 2 hours to live in the hospital. That sucks. But I managed to survive because I'm like Wolverine. I was herping in Switzerland.
I think you got teddy bear confused with Wolverine.
I was herping in Switzerland and I stupidly went off on my own looking for salamanders. And I was on a sort of side of a mountain and I leant on what I thought was a tree and it turned out to be completely rotten and it just gave way, so I fell over the edge there, which was clever. Fortunately, it wasn't sheer, it was kind of sloped, but I ended up 60 feet lower than I started with all my kit spread across the place and smashed myself up quite badly doing that. What else have I done? Oh, do you know what the most painful and irritating thing I've done? I was herping looking for the Greek meadow viper in Greece, obviously, and I got bit by a horsefly and my leg swelled up to twice the size so that he couldn't see where the knee was and it wouldn't bend, and that was halfway through the herp trip.
Oh no.
And I'd paid a lot of money, so I'm walking like it was my first morning after my first night in prison. And it took about 2 or 3 days for the swelling to go. Horseflies are horrible things, and I've still got a scar on my leg from the actual bite.
Yeah, the horse flies over here will fucking fly you away.
Yeah, it's just nasty. Absolutely nasty. So that's about it, I think.
Phil?
I can say, knock on wood, that I have not yet received a injury while herping worthy enough to tell on this podcast.
That just sounds to me like you don't go herping enough.
Very true, very true. But I will say, just speaking about herping friends and having companions on trips, I was out in the Everglades once with a group of friends, one herper friend and then two lady friends that wanted to see some wilderness. And I went out to a spot that was, for the most part, all paved roads. We walked a little bit, nothing crazy, but one of our friends has lupus and was in kidney failure and had been battling it for quite some time. And she had a port in her chest for her dialysis. And when we were exiting the wilderness area, she started to get chest pains. And she's like, man, this is not good. We got to go. And then it just got worse. And she's screaming and in agonizing heart pain. And we floored it. We went as fast as we humanly could. And we got out of there and got to the hospital. And she wound up having multiple blood clots throughout her body from a dialysis issue. She survived that, but sadly, about a year or two later, she passed away from
that. Sorry for that. Sorry to hear that, mate.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah,
that was probably the scariest thing on a herp trip ever. Because you think about people that have fallen and broke legs and, God forbid, gotten bit by venom stuff, but have someone screaming about chest pain, and I'm not a paramedic. I know how to treat hiking wounds and possible snake bite scenarios, but yeah. I was not prepared for that. So it just goes to show you, like, have an idea of how you're going to get home and make sure that GPS is good to go. And I mean, I knew where I was going, but imagine if it was me and they didn't know how to go home.
We've obviously suffered a few injuries and stuff like that when we've been out.
No, I'm unco as fuck. That's why I asked that question. I like hearing other people are too.
yeah. I've fallen down cliffs due to rotten branches and stuff like that. I went down a waterfall and that kind of sucked. I've been bitten by things, and the worst thing was is I didn't drink enough water and got severely dehydrated as well. So I ended up losing too much of my bowel.
Substitute, yeah. Not enough for any.
yeah, not a fun thing. And then anaphylaxis when you're out on a herp trip isn't good either. Anyway, such is life. Who do you admire most in your professional circle? Phil, go with you first, and then we'll jump to Nipper.
Well, I mean, if you want to talk podcasts, there's so many people, but our good friend Chris Bainshop in East Texas, he's got a Kingsnake podcast right now, but he's just such a stand-up individual. And we always had the joke, like, how would Chris handle this? He's a family man. He loves his wife and kid. He's got all his animals in a sterling collection. He goes out in the field every chance he gets. He gets his daughter involved with all the gecko breeding and the snake breeding. He's got a full-time job and a family, and he handles it.
Yeah. He's so horribly positive as well.
Yeah, he's horribly positive.
Oh, no, he's great. Absolutely great.
Yeah. So I think in like a podcast, private keeping world, I'd say probably Chris Panchev for sure. And then honestly, in the academics, I got to go Mark O'Shea, man. He's a legend, and I love that he knows how to have fun, but then also knows how to be serious. And I feel like it's difficult to be as worldly and academic as he is, but then also still be able to go to the pub and tear it up and have a great time and have camaraderie and have people still respect you for both. I think that's really great. Dipper?
I'm going to give a safe answer, but it's absolutely true. I'm really blessed with the people I know. Everyone that I talk to on my friends list, I am just inspired by all the time.
Okay.
I'm really fortunate with yourselves, Eric, Rob, Keith, all those people.
Phil.
Dustin, Dustin. When I say yourselves, I mean people I can see on this podcast at the minute. Phil, I can't stand him.
It's the guns, isn't it?
It's the guns. It's the guns. Yeah. No, I'm really fortunate. Look at you with your books and your podcasts, and Eric with his podcasts, Dustin and Justin, the Field Herpin and the books. I'm surrounding myself with really interesting people. I admire all of them.
That was a lovely answer.
I think for us, there's a lot of people that we admire, but a particular couple that comes to mind for me is both Keith and Teresa. Such beautiful people, such lovely people, and so easy to get along with. We had the fortune of catching up with them in person about 13, 14 months ago. We spoke a bit beforehand, but since then we've spoken so much more on digital means and all that sort of stuff. They're such great people. And then from a professional side of things, as a mentor for us, as Hal Cogger for us is probably the one person that you absolutely love chatting with Hal and Heather anytime we get the opportunity to.
I would have said you in early days, but the honeymoon period's over. Guys, what are the top three podcasts that you'd recommend our listeners check out?
Oh, that's a hard one.
Obviously,
Venom Exchange Radio.
Obviously.
For sure.
Go on, Phil, you can go first. I need some thinking time. That's a big question.
I'll say, first off, is it Herpetology Highlights or Herpetoculture Highlights? I think it's Herpetology Highlights, right?
Yeah.
Herpetologists, yeah.
Those guys, they have so much fun. They bring fun to academics that can be stuffy and boring. And it's just two good friends chatting about the newest findings, the newest research in a fun way.
Yeah.
Definitely check that out.
Yeah, Tom and Ben are great, aren't they?
Most definitely. So my co-host on another show, Justin Smith, him and our friend Niesberg started a Arachnids podcast called Arach Nerds. For all those bug nerds out there. And I've seen the lineup of guests that they're going to have on for the invert community, both tarantulas and scorpions and everything in between. And they're going to have some really cool people coming on and some really cool animals to talk about.
Yeah.
So that I say people should definitely listen to. And it's tough because I kind of do like the revolving door, but obviously if people are listening to this, they need to listen to NPR because Rally by the Radio, the podfather himself, like just all the avenues that you can get to from listening to that show is paramount, in my opinion.
I think too, like the NPR library is so extensive. The amount of historic episodes that they have, you don't necessarily need to be interested in carpet pythons to find something that's there in their back catalogue that you would find interesting.
Yeah, agreed. Different.
I would agree exactly with what you just said. Matthew Wayne has got a podcast, and for the life of me, I'm having a brain fart and I can't remember. I'm just trying to see what the podcast is called. But I really admire Matthew for what he's doing, and I really like his podcast, but I cannot remember the name of it.
What's the subject of it, Nipper? Because we'll make sure we get it in the show notes for
Literally, the minute I finish talking, I will remember it. This is what it's like getting old. It's a General Herp podcast. Okay. He's very into his salamanders and stuff like that, but it's a really good podcast. And I love the fact, and he won't mind me saying it, Matthew's in AA and his herping and his podcast is what he puts all his energy and focus in to keep him on a good path. So I really, really like his podcast. So enthusiastic as well. It's really cool.
You got to admire the brutal honesty there too.
100%, 100%. I really like Amphibocast just for constantly putting out stuff and constantly having good guests on. As Phil said, I love Colubrid and Colubrid Radio. There's just so many. Yeah. It's hard to pick a favourite.
What do you guys like most about hosting a podcast?
For me, I get to chat to people that I never thought I'd chat to. And I love listening to people's herping stories, even Scott's.
Even those brown things that no one likes?
Even when he phones me up and I'm working my guts out to tell me that he's found this rare little lizard down a hole. No, we're really fortunate. Phil and I have chatted to some really, in this sphere, famous people. And they've been so open and, yeah.
Yeah, like speaking to Johan Murray and Steve Spalls and...
Exactly.
Yeah, like fucking absolute gods of African herpetoculture.
Yeah.
You've had some cracker episodes.
Yeah, and they're just chatting away and telling us their stories. It's fascinating. By far the best thing.
Yeah.
Steve Spall's book on sun, sand and snakes, right? I remember reading that like probably 20 years ago. And
exactly.
It's such a great read. It's almost like, look, it's not as good as Song of the Snake by Eric Worrell. But it's like an African version of that. And Jesus Christ, what a great book. And people don't pick books up these days so much in that sense.
No, it's the same.
You know?
My favourite thing from that particular podcast that we did was the fact that he lost a finger and he was like, whatever, just crack on. he was so English about it. Like, oh, yeah, I lost a finger. It wasn't a big deal and I was at work the next day. Yeah, you know, it's just...
He would have been more upset if you had a shit cup of tea.
100%. Yeah, 100%.
Phil?
Oh, man, everything he just said, he took the words out of my mouth. The fact that I get to... All right, they always have the running thing of, like, never meet your idols, right? Never meet your favorite actor, never meet your favorite musician. But in herpetoculture, herpetology, they're typically wonderful people. I get to talk to the Ipers, which is funny now, right? But 20 years ago, I would have never imagined. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And just the ability to interact with people that on a human level that you guys are relating to. It doesn't matter. I'm stumbling over my words because I'm so elated by this particular question. It's a great feeling to know that I'm not alone in the way that I think, the way in the things that I love. And then there's other people that love it as much, if not more than I do, and have completely different perspectives and infinite amount of knowledge. So I selfishly get to learn from them directly. And that's, I think it's awesome.
I think too, we all keep animals in boxes, right? Or we all go out and herp together and all that sort of stuff. We've all got this shared passion. No artificial level that somebody's a bit higher than somebody else.
Yeah.
We're all here, if you break it all down, the lowest common denominator is that we all have a passion for the natural world.
We all know stuff, so it's just different things.
Yeah. And being able to try and leave the ego at the door, I mean, we all have fucking egos, so pretending that it doesn't exist isn't there, but if we can try and leave it at the door a little bit and just have that enjoyable conversation for what it is, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Selfishly for me, when I got bit, I had two people on speed dial that knew more than the doctors that were treating me. So absolutely
it's convenient,
perfect.
Though, isn't it?
It is very convenient, very useful.
We've had similar instances where we've got people that we can rely on and that sort of thing. And then the other side of it is it's not only for the doctors, but it's also for their partners. So their partners 100%. Can be rest assured that, okay, this is the right course of action or this is what to do and this is what you should be expecting.
Yeah.
Because at that point in time, they're worried because the doctors are worried and they can pick up from the doctors that the doctors are worried and so then they become worried. Yeah. And then having someone come in and be able to calm the situation down a little bit and go, this is what's going to happen, this is what you should be expecting, allows them to mentally prepare for the next headache that's coming.
Do you know what it also 100%. Is from a female's point of view? Your male partner, your husband, your boyfriend, whatever, is lying there in the bed. This was your lack of water. This wasn't a snake bite. Lying there incapacitated. and you always imagine the male to be strong, reliable, and all of a sudden they actually look weak. And it's a shock to the system because you don't know what's going to happen.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I feel bad now. Yeah.
So you should. You're still fucking drinking Pepsi Max.
I know Ali was exceptionally grateful to be able to talk to you two and Phil in real time. It really helped her.
What do you least like about doing a podcast? I mean, for us, it's the fucking times. Trying to organise to get the times right is always a nightmare.
I thought you were going to say the editing and I was going to go, what the fuck, dude?
I wasn't going to say that. I'm not that stupid. Well, I am that stupid, but I wouldn't say that.
For me, and I think Phil's probably say the same thing, it's trying to not pin down a guest because that sounds unpleasant, but trying to, as you say, everyone's on different time zones, everyone has different internet capabilities, and to try and juggle all that to come together for one unique time, it can be difficult.
Or if someone, and you know, it is actually unavoidable, someone cans it last minute and you're like, oh shit, yeah. I don't have anyone, like, because we try and do it monthly, and you're like, ring a mate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the thing for me.
Yeah. What advice would you give someone just starting out in the hobby?
Oh, go on, Phil, you can take that.
I would say, this is going to be a little long, well, before I ever got my first tattoo, and hear me out, kid, my friend who was heavily tattooed told me to print out a picture or draw a sketch of what I want that tattoo to be, and then use some tape and tape it to my bathroom mirror. That way I have to look at it every single day for about 3 months or 4 months, and if I'm still not sick of it, then go get it. Now, obviously, we don't always follow that because all of us have some pretty gnarly tattoos that we just want to get on the back. But the concept is still there, and I try to convey the same thing to Keeping Reptiles. Mm-hmm. Do your homework, right?
Yeah.
There are tropical fish people that have these beautiful saltwater fish tanks. They don't just go buy the fish and then go home and scramble to put something together and read a book real quick. No, they have the tank set up for weeks, if not months, to get the water right, to get the lighting right. And they're researching the animal, and they're researching the animal, they're researching the animal, and they start to shut out for the animal, and they find the right breeder and whatnot. That's how it needs to be, is figure out what you want. No one says you can't have X, Y, and Z crazy, unique, rare thing as your first animal. But A, you probably shouldn't, because there's a reason why it's on that level or that pedestal, whatever.
Yeah.
B, half the fun is learning about it and getting familiar with it, being ready so that when you do get the animal, you're already set up, you're ready to rock it. Oh, and you have that confidence knowing that you learned all that you could in that time to be ready for what you're taking care of now. And now you get to continue to learn as you observe. And I feel like that's a huge thing, whether it's a little gecko that's $25 or it's freaking, I don't know, Boland's pythons, whatever you want to go, you know, insert extreme animal.
Yeah.
Awesome. Nipper?
I would completely echo with what Phil said. Just add, I would say, keep what you like and are interested in, not what's trendy at that particular time.
Or what you're told is a beginner animal.
Or what you're told is a beginner animal, yep. Or what you're told is the thing you should be keeping because everyone else is keeping at the minute.
Yep.
If you like little brown jobs, just keep little brown jobs. You know, don't have to keep, you know, no offence, Phil, obviously. You know, if you want to keep snakes in trays of in traits in dirt, you do that. That's absolutely fine.
I will, goddammit.
So we've got a viewer question from Cammy Dalrymple. Reptiles are arguably quite the niche subject. You've been doing this podcast on large platforms such as Spotify and YouTube for close to 3 years now. What are you finding your biggest challenges are with finding topics of discussion and maintaining an active listener base?
We're quite fortunate because we do quite a niche podcast. So there is always some topics for discussion because there's new papers coming out or we can get a guest from a different part of the world that we haven't talked about for a while or something like that. I think if you've got a more generalistic podcast, it's a lot harder. But for Phil and I, because we try and keep strictly to Venomous, I think there is enough for us to keep going.
In fairness, though, Venomous Exchange Radio has got a fucking massive platform in some ways, in the sense that you could be talking about venomous fish, you could be talking about spiders, scorpions, centipedes.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big hydra in a lot of ways of some of the shit that you guys are talking about.
Yeah.
I plan on having a blue ring octopus person on. I want to find a platypus person, and I want to find someone who's a Stoloris expert and get them on. So there's ample opportunity.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely. Have you ever witnessed or experienced misogyny throughout your careers? And in your opinion, what could be done to help stamp it out?
Nothing I would say that's robustly misogynistic. I do think, or I do feel, that particularly online, any female that's keeping venomous is considered less able, less well-researched than a bloke purely because it's a girl, which makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. But I haven't particularly witnessed anything that I feel that I would have to pull somebody up on.
Phil?
Yeah, I would agree in that stance. I know there was a time when it was trendy for women who were venomous keepers specifically to do things on camera to get more clicks and more likes. And I'm sure that the keyboard commandos may have attempted to tarnish them, but they're still doing a fantastic job. And I've never personally witnessed it or seen it, but I've heard it from other female friends that have maybe had issues with certain individuals. But for the most part, I feel like this community is so lifting and has such a good level of togetherness that I don't really see it. I'm not saying it's not there, but I personally haven't really experienced it with my female friends. If anything, it's almost been the opposite of people being proud of them for jumping into what was traditionally a man's hobby, a man's community. And now it's very much growing to be equal. Forgive me if that sounded so chauvinistic.
No, that's okay. It seems like in certain circles that the women have overtaken the men. It seems like in spiders that there's almost more women spider keepers than there is men.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I've definitely seen that.
Guys, we do a little segment called 60 Seconds Under the Basking Spot. I'm going to fire them at both of yous. Do you guys prefer to drive or sit in the passenger seat?
Drive.
Oh, mm-hmm. Drive, yeah.
Optimist or realist?
Realist.
Realist. Pragmatist.
Hook or hand?
Depends on the species.
Hook, always. Hook always because I am slow.
Accomplice or ringleader?
Ringleader.
No.
I go accomplice.
Sweet or savory?
Savory.
Sweet.
Always, Phil, always.
Yep. American way.
Has nothing to do with the dating app whatsoever?
None whatsoever.
Order or spontaneity?
Oh, my God. Order all day long.
Yeah, order.
Apple or Android?
Apple.
Apple.
Not an animal.
For life.
Introvert or extrovert?
Introvert.
Oh, I want to say introvert, but my significant other will scream extrovert.
Yeah, you're definitely a fucking extrovert, mate.
Yeah, I know.
Sleep on the right side of the bed or the left?
Left.
It honestly depends on if I'm at my girl's house or my house because of where the bed is against the wall. But I think if she had her way, it would always be on the left.
And finally, does pineapple go on a pizza?
Fuck no.
Ooh.
Thank you.
Nah. Nah.
Fucking heathens. Period.
Guys, what's the one takeaway you'd like the listeners to get from this episode?
Other than we've got to get Nipper's Instagram likes over 1,000.
Yes, that is the only thing I would like to take away from this episode. Just enjoy your herping and keeping. Don't bother with what everybody else is doing. Do what you want to do. Just enjoy it. And be safe.
Cool.
Yeah, I'll second that. Be safe. Be proud of what you've seen, what you've found, what you've learned. Be happy about it because there's so many not nice things in this world. And we have this community. We have these animals. And it doesn't matter if it's a little anole in your backyard or if it's the rarest species on the planet that you've been hunting for a decade. Be proud of what you've seen and what you've learned and the people that you get to relate that with.
That was lovely.
That was very nice. He speaks so eloquently when he's on camera.
Is there anything we haven't covered, guys, that you would like to mention before we close out?
Yes. Follow me on Instagram, please.
Oh, I think we're going to make sure that we have something in the fucking show. No. I'm actually half tempted to put something on Nature for You, right, just today. Yeah, please follow Nipper Reed. Otherwise, he's going to have an aneurysm.
Exactly.
And he takes decent photos of incredible European herpetofauna.
Not too bad photos.
Phil, was there anything you
wanted? I was just going to say, people that are listening to this, Nature for You ships international. They have some of the coolest books you'll ever see. So selfless plug for their website. Go buy the books. Have them shipped wherever you need them. You will not be disappointed. And then Do you guys have any projects in the near future that you'd like to disclose or keep us in suspense?
Not that we can share on air, no.
Not just yet. Okay. Not just yet. But let's just say we are always busy.
That's good.
Yes, and me with your books.
So as we're doing a crossover episode and you're coming on to our podcast in real terms, we've got a question that we'd like to ask you. I'm going to ask Ty, first of all. Is there a particular species, it doesn't have to be venomous, but we normally ask venomous, that you want to see in the wild and you haven't been able to find up to now?
This is embarrassing. And
it's going to be a rattlesnake. Oh, what? Sorry?
Acanthopus. That's what
Seriously?
I mean. It's embarrassing. Yes.
Are you even Australian?
No, I'm not.
Are you actually? Is this just a green screen and you're actually living in Balham in London or something?
One of our mates, every time he goes up the mountain, sends me picture after picture. And he's like, yep, fuck going out with Scott. You need to come out with me. We'll get at us.
Oh, my days. Yeah. I'm absolutely stunned.
I mean, don't you guys just have them under your trash bin?
We did until we had chain toes, mate. No, I think the part that I find funniest is that the first adder Ty ever saw in the wild was Berris.
That's mad, but also a cracking species.
For us too, though, it's time, because we pretty much have book contract after book contract after book contract. You get to the point where you know the contract's coming to a close and you're like, fuck, do I go out herping and maybe get some new photos, or do I write and know that that's going to get done because I may not see what I need to? So we usually end up writing, unfortunately.
Yeah. For me,
what about you, Scott?
It's a toss-up. Shedeckis papuanus, the Papuan black snake, because I am so Shedeckis obsessed, is right up there. Lachesis melanocephala is right up there as well, the black-headed bushmaster. And then the other one I'd love to see is Oxyuranus temporalis, the Central Ranges type ant. All three of those are massively high on my want-to-see list.
And I'm that horrified that I haven't seen an adder in the wild. I'll be happy with any.
Okay, and just to further put you on the spot, what species of rattlesnake do you want to see more than anything else?
Eastern diamondback.
Melosis. Not even fucking close. Really? I understand they must be the most underrated species of rattlesnake out there. I think a beautiful Arizona black tail that's almost lemon yellow with an incredibly black tail is just one of those enigmatic rattlesnakes. It's quintessential. It's got that beautiful size to it, incredibly beautiful, and yet people go, oh, I want to see a Lepidus or a Clouberi or an Adamantius. I mean, I appreciate all of those, but Jesus, Melosis, they are the best.
You get to the point where the holiday might not happen. The herping trip might not happen. Well, I do it anyway. I'm like, yeah, any fucking species. I don't mind as long as it is a rattlesnake.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
All right, so. Returning the question, return serve.
For me, if we're talking rattlesnakes, I think mine still is Obscurus or Pricei at the moment. That would be very exciting. But I'm like you. As soon as I get to America, I'm like a child and anything I see, frog, toad,
it's
salamander or anything.
Yeah, it's a good moment.
It's something. I'm hoping when we go to Pennsylvania that Zach has sorted out us to swim with hellbenders, and that will be a life tick.
Wow.
I just love being in the water with animals, so a hellbender would just blow me away.
Hell yeah.
In terms of worldwideness, probably a blue crite or something like that, something of those species.
So Calliophus
Calliophus, yeah. That'd probably be one of the things that I really want to photograph.
Yeah, because that's the problem with crates, is that whether it's Bungarus candidus or Calliophus bivagata, or which is the one that you like the most, any of them would be fucking good.
100%. What about you, Phil?
I'll say, just to put the dagger in Scott a little more, when we were in the Franklin Mountains looking for Clouberi, we were finding Melosis's bycatch.
I don't mind the fact that they're relatively common. That's not a fact.
Oh, no, but they're stunning.
It doesn't change the fact
the
that it's incredibly
beautiful. Yeah, oh, for sure.
And besides, my other three are fucking tough. Lachesis melanocephala is tough. Papuanus is tough. Temporalis is fucking tough. So I don't mind that I've got an easy one in there.
I love it. I love it all. I think for me, this year will hopefully be my first time leaving this fucking continent. So my aspirations are delusions of grandeur, I should say. I definitely want to find Legionis in Morocco. I think that's like very top of my list. I want to find Wolternesia in Egypt or Israel, in that neck of the woods. And honestly, I got to go to South Africa and find wrinkles. It's got to happen.
At some point in time, I reckon we should try and organise a cold-blooded contributions Venomous Exchange Radio Herb trip somewhere.
That would be awesome.
1,000%.
Where can our listeners find you guys?
You can get me on Instagram at Nipper Reed would be the best place.
Are they going to find you there, mate, or what?
They'll find me on Instagram if they bother. Two of my three dogs is the little avatar. People do tend to friend request me on Facebook. I very, very rarely go on Facebook. So if you want to have a chat or get in touch, message me through Instagram is the best way.
Cool.
Well, my personal Instagram is knobtails.ig. The page was actually started as a Knobtail Gecko page, and it's kind of evolved from there. So knobtails.ig. And then, of course, Venom Exchange Radio on Instagram and YouTube. And if you feel so compelled, go to venomexchangeradio.com, and we have some amazing merch. You can get your Dirt Snake Mafia t-shirt or your Hood Tats t-shirt or whatever you want. Cell phone holder, coffee cup. It's international. Enjoy.
Excellent. Excellent. We definitely need to get a Dirt Snake Mafia t-shirt at some point in time.
For sure. Yeah, Venom Exchange Radio, everywhere podcasts are listened to. We're on Google Play, Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, YouTube Podcasts now. I'm slowly upgrading all the backlog to YouTube Podcasts. So for the five people that listen to it, it's on there too.
It's not a five-minute process, is it?
No, but I'll tell you, I've streamlined it to be pretty good. I'm trying to be a good boy and do at least one every couple of days just so the algorithm catches up. But I didn't realize that YouTube had their own podcast thing. So
yeah.
I figure I'm uploading videos, I might as well upload the podcast too.
Yeah.
For the people on Venomous Exchange Radio, because this is a crossover episode, you guys can find us on Facebook at Nature4U or the Cold Blooded Contributions podcast. You can also get both Ty and I individually on Facebook, Ty Iper, Scott Iper, and we're on Instagram as well as Nature4U, and then there's also Scott Iper as well on Instagram. Or you can reach us via our website, because we are ancient and we also use websites, at www.wildlifedemonstrations.com. You can get books and information and stuff like that as well.
Thanks for listening to the Cold Blooded Contributions podcast. The Cold Blooded Contributions podcast is proudly sponsored by Midwest Tongs. For over 40 years, the Midwest Tongs team has provided the highest quality snake handling tools made in the USA. Made by professionals for professionals. Visit Midwest Tongs at www.tongs.com. A massive thank you to our guests, Sniffer and Phil. We really appreciate you guys taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us. Usually we'll be releasing our podcast monthly, so make sure you follow us so you don't miss out on an episode. Give the Cold Blooded Contributions podcast a like on Facebook so you don't miss any updates, giveaways or guest announcements. The links discussed in today's podcast will be in the show notes. And always remember to trust your creativity. It's intelligence having fun.